This is Rock Isn't Dead, It's Just Sleeping. With your hosts, William Whitebread and Mark Audio Slave Stewart. Welcome to another brutal episode of Rock Isn't Dead, It's Just Sleeping with me,
Willie Whitebread, and
Mark Audio Slave.
Woo! Okay, so this is the third and final episode on metal. We're going to finish up the thrash metal scene and touch on a little bit of what came next and a little bit of what came before. Right, Marcus?
Yeah, let's do it.
Right. So last week we went over Metallica. We went through the kind of late middle, late 70s, early 80s, mid 80s thrash metal movement. And we went over Megadeth. And we went through Metallica and their rise to stardom, but we missed two of the most prominent of the big four.
Right.
Anthrax and Slayer.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So Anthrax, being the unique band that they are, they were kind of a funny band. They played a lot with comedy.
They did.
A lot of comedy in their music, which was cool.
Yeah.
That was a cool touch on it, especially being, you know, a thrash metal band.
Right.
And they were also the only band that was formed outside of California out of the Big Four. Not out of all thrash metal ever, but out of the Big Four.
Well, so considering they talk like this.
Yeah. I don't know that I've ever heard an interview.
Hello, I'm Ian, and we're from Anthrax.
Scott, is that how he talks?
That's how he talks.
Scott Ian?
Yes.
He looks like such a brutal motherfucker, man.
He talks like this.
Yeah, and I think he's the only founding father of Anthrax left, even.
Yeah, well, he was the look,
yeah.
You know?
Which is odd, right, for the guitar player to be the look. Usually it's the front man.
Yeah, it's his goatee. That's what it is, because it's down to his freaking knees.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, I think he's only like 5'3", so
yeah,
it's not very far to go.
Nah.
But anyway, so Anthrax formed in Queens, New York, July 18th, 1981, by guitarist, as formerly mentioned, Scott Ian and Dan Lilker. Yes.
Loker or Lickler?
I think it's Lilker.
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 Anywho.
Yeah, their entire original lineup was John Connolly on the, and then drummer Dave Weiss and bassist Paul Kahn. And shortly after Kahn was there, he was replaced by bassist Kenny Kushner before Lilker took over on bass, and Greg Walls joined as a lead guitarist. So they're going to play the game that pretty much every other band, Metallica had a little bit of trading back and forth, but they're going to play the game that every other band played.
Mm-hmm.
Well, every other thrash metal band in that time of the Big Four, and they're going to swap members like fucking tampons.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I don't think it was like hardcore, like, yo, you're not playing right, dude. You're out.
I think that was the Megadeth thing.
I think it was, that was the Mustaine deal. I think it was more along the lines of like, oh, you got shit going on, bro? I'm sorry. Okay, we'll get somebody else. You know,
yeah.
That's the kind of thing.
That's how they talk.
That's how they did it.
You got something going on this Sunday? Okay, I can get that you can't practice.
I understand. You
got
to go to church.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so then Weiss was replaced by Greg DeAngelo, and then Scott Ian's younger brother, Jason Rosenfeld, was a temporary vocalist until Ian's former schoolmate and one of their most prominent frontmen, Neil Turbin, joined the band in late August of 1982. So they were all around the same exact time.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were all there.
Right place, right time.
Right place, right time, right place for a genre.
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is unique, too, because like we were talking about, this is the same time that, you know, the new wave of British heavy metal, we're talking about your Saxons, your Iron Maidens, your Diamond Heads, Angel Witch, you know, Satan, shit like that.
Yeah.
That had just came through in the mid, late 70s, and hardcore punk was just now coming around.
Yeah.
You know, with that too, so Bad Brains, Black Flag, Minor Threat, shit like that.
Yeah.
So these guys are all forming separate scenes in the same era, which is unique because you don't ever see that anymore. Right,
it's one of those things, man. Like you said, it was just the right place and the right time, you know. And it was kind of like, you know, they were on the same record label as Metallica.
Yeah,
so that helped a lot.
Well, they also were the last one to get a major record deal.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Because we're talking about the John and I think her name is Martha Zazula.
Yeah.
We're talking about the Megadeth record stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Or Megaforce.
Megaforce.
Megaforce record. That they did sign with those guys. What was it? 83. I think it was right after Metallica released Kill 'Em All.
Yep.
Their initial album.
Yep.
They signed with Megaforce Records with John Zanzula and all that kind of stuff. Because they had made friends with him. Anthrax played a few shows with Metallica. And I remember watching a documentary on thrash metal and seeing and hearing that, like firsthand, that nobody believed in Metallica whatsoever. Who are you looking at that out there? We're live on Facebook right now.
I was just seeing if Audio Slave. I was just looking to see if anybody's on there.
Audio Slave. Nobody's on there, dude. Nobody cares.
Whoa.
Yeah. See. Hi, guys.
Yeah. Well.
But anyway, so nobody cared about him. Nobody believed in Metallica. Nobody gave a shit about Metallica except for this guy, John Zanzula, and his wife. I think it was either Margaret, Martha. Watch it be fucking Tiffany or something. No, I don't know. You know, completely. Some guy on the other end is like, "Fuck this fucking guy sucks."
Yeah.
You don't know shit about shit. But so they Anthrax signed with Megaforce Records very, very shortly after Metallica's debut album Kill 'Em All came out, and then and that was in late 1983. So they signed with Megaforce Records, and the band started recording the Soldiers of Metal single. Which was produced by Ross, the Boss of Manowar.
Love those guys.
Manowar?
Yeah.
Sick.
Yeah.
Super sick.
Kings of Metal, especially that album.
Kings of Metal.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good one.
And they have a Ode to Odin, which is like a symphonic song that they did. It's very hard to find. I actually have it.
Yeah.
But it's a really good, really good song if you guys want to listen.
Yeah, there you go. So, In addition to the thrash metal thing going on, you had multiple other genres happening at the same time as well. Because I didn't really understand the fact that they had all of these different genres, you know.
Well, I don't think at the time they had these classifications. I think that was later, like in early 2000s when people
They came out with the classifications.
Started giving them labels.
Yeah.
You know, back then it was just like, oh yeah, they rock, man. Oh yeah, they're thrashing. You know, oh yeah, those guys rock, man. They're killing it on stage.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like, oh well, those guys are doom metal and these guys are new metal. You know, it wasn't like that.
But it was all the same around the same time. You know what I mean? And it was all that race like we spoke about before on the previous episodes of thrash metal. It was that race for the harder, faster, stronger sound.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because later on, like you said, you know, I think you're exactly right there. You had like crossover thrash with Suicidal Tendencies and SOD, right?
Yeah.
And then you had speed metal, which was like Exciter and Venom. And then you had power metal, which was like Halloween, which we spoke about earlier, that you do not like whatsoever.
Okay, not really.
Right. And then at the same time, because you had the thrash guys that were beating out, they come up with thrash because of glam, you know, because fuck glam.
Right.
And then you got the punk rock guys on the scene who were, you know, thrashing with the thrash metal guys about who's heavier and whose fucking statement about revolutionary government takedown is more prominent at the time.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you've got death metal coming out with bands like Morbid Angel.
And we're the heaviest of heavy.
Yeah, and then they're just fucking bringing it to another level. And then you got bands like Ministry coming out.
Industrial
metal coming out, which is fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's just crazy to me how that whole intricate system of different metal genres fucking works.
And then I kind of think that goth metal kind of spawned from a mixture of industrial and...
What would be considered goth metal?
Marilyn Manson.
Marilyn Manson?
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely, for sure.
You think?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, there's a couple. A band called The Birthday Massacre is another good example of some goth.
Because I've heard of gothic rock. Like, I've heard of The Cure being described as gothic rock.
The Cure is more just college alternative.
College alternative.
That's what it was classified.
Why would
back
it be
then.
College alternative?
That's what it was classified.
Oh,
it was like The Cure and Morrissey and, you know, I can't think of anybody else.
Just bullshit like that.
It was just stuff like that. You know, all these little
college radio station playing things.
Exactly.
That's
high school
what it
and
was.
College girls would listen to in their bedroom at night while they were, you know.
Yeah. And you're never going
to
get
talking
anything.
To their boyfriend.
Yeah, right. And then on the other side of the fence, too, so what we've got now? We've got crossover thrash. We've got death metal. We've got thrash metal. We've got power metal. We've got gothic metal, right? And we mentioned punk. So another thing that's starting to come around during the same time of the Big Four, the Slayer, Metallica, you know, Anthrax and Megadeth, you've got grunge starting. you've got that whole swap around starting, right? Because Soundgarden started in 84.
Yeah.
With their original LP with Hiro Yamamoto as their lead singer on Screamin' Life. That LP, that was starting. The guys in Pearl Jam started in Green River, right? Alice in Chains was tossing shit around. You had Nirvana.
The whole Seattle scene was blowing the fuck up.
It wasn't blowing up, but it was starting.
The California scene and the New York scene were all... going off. So
that's crazy.
So many genres just popping at the same time.
The U.S. was just in one giant.
And don't forget, then you had like Rage Against the Machine going off, you know, with a whole new type of genre, you know, like rap rock, I guess that you would call that. You know,
rap rock.
They were like the godfathers of rap rock, like Linkin Park to follow, and Fever 333. Another one.
I think Anthrax actually might have started that movement with that shit that they did with
the Attack of the Killer Bees with the Judgment Night soundtrack, right? Public Enemy.
Public Enemy, yeah. Bring the Noise.
Flava Flav.
Yeah.
Yeah, boy.
Beast, how low can you go? Yeah. That bullshit. So, like I said, Anthrax in late 1983 signs with Megaforce Records. Hey, look, we got somebody watching. Look, wave to him. Hey, we got somebody watching on Facebook Live. That's cool. It's probably my wife. see what the fuck I'm doing out here trying to tell me it's dinner.
Or time. Mike Martinez.
Yeah, or Mike Martinez. So you've got, like we said, they're signed with Megaforce Records after Metallica released Kill 'Em All. So then they're going to release their debut album, Fistful of Metal, January 1984.
Yeah.
That's when they're going to start their stuff, right? And they still have got, what's his face? Neil Turbin. They've still got him. They haven't reached their golden years yet. They're still very green and very new. And they're also another band, Anthrax, that stuck with their roots.
Yeah.
They stuck with the thrash roots to the bitter end. You see them, you know, if they come on an Ozfest or anything like that, they are still playing thrash.
Yeah.
All of them are. Metallica's really the only one that kind of broke out of the big four and started making that progressive rock.
With the rap rock stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, they tried to break out a little bit. But they needed help. It wasn't like they were doing it by themselves.
Right, you know? Right. So tensions at this time, after the Fistful of Metal album, tensions are building between Lilker and the rest of the bands for a numerous, you know, myriad of different shit. And it eventually led to the band firing Lilker.
Okay.
Which sucks. I mean, because he was good. But he broke off and started doing that thing. Because what was happening in the 80s? What was the big scare in our economy in the 80s? Nuclear war, right?
Yeah.
We were fucking with the Cold War, so everybody was worried about nuclear warfare.
Yeah.
Right? So Lilker broke off, and he formed the band Nuclear Assault with one of Anthrax's former roadies, John Connolly, which is interesting, because I don't know if you hear too much about people swapping spit with roadies, you know what I mean? Starting bands with roadies, that's kind of a unique concept, wouldn't you think?
Well, yes. Well, I hear, you know, Filter, those guys weren't roadies, though. They were actually Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah, they were Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah. You don't hear too much about the roadies. Well, you know, Billy Idol was a roadie.
Was he really?
He was.
For who?
Rolling Stones.
Really?
Yeah. And he had to go get Keith Richards whiskey one night.
Mm.
And Keith Richards wanted a brand of whiskey called Rebel Yell. That's where he got the title of the song.
Yeah. Rebel Yell.
Yeah.
Go give me the Rebel Yell, you Billy.
Yeah. Keith cried mo.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh. Fucking Keith Richards, man. He gives me hope.
Yeah, right.
He really gives me hope, dude. That guy literally looks like a goblin from Labyrinth.
Yeah, I saw that meme. Put this picture side by side. It looks exactly like
him. I forget what that little goblin's name is, but he looks just like the fuck.
He does.
You know?
He does.
I wonder if we can cuss on Facebook. Can we cuss on Facebook?
Fuck yeah.
Can we?
Yes.
Fuck that.
Who cares?
Cool beans. Yeah, fuck the man. Down with the system. Right. I'm going to vape and do all this fucking shit. Anyway, so moving forward, you've got, once again, all those members of the Big Four back in the day, they were sharing tours. Right, and they were starting to share their tours with their their idols.
But you know, Anthrax was kind of always pushed as the front runner. They were always kind of like the opening band. They were never, you know, I don't know if you say they're termed good enough, but they were never popular enough to be anything but an opener.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say they were that the entire time.
So I would,
really.
Do you really think that Megadeth, Metallica, or Slayer is going to let Anthrax taking over their spots, their billing?
I'm talking more in the sense of they're sharing tours in the sense of their...
Well, with other bands, yes.
Right.
They're sharing...
If they were playing a show with Bouncing Souls, of course, Anthrax would be, you know, the headliner that night. But I'm talking about the big four.
Right, and funny enough, man, there's this guy in Waycross, Georgia. I found him on Craigslist. He's got an Anthrax and Megadeth signed CD that he's selling for $20 a piece. They're probably fake, but for $20, I'm willing to gamble on it.
Hey, I have a couple things signed. What do you want? I'll get you what you want, man.
I don't
want
to hear your shit.
Don't worry about the COC.
I don't want to see your shit.
Or COA. What do they call that? COA.
Yeah, certificate of whatever. So after their...
he just printed off his computer.
Yeah. So after releasing the Fistful of Metal album, they went on a successful tour opening for every single one of the thrash band's consistent idols, Raven. And Raven was considered a shock rock band because shock rock came out before. Shock rock came out a little bit before the thrash metal scene came out because we were talking about, well, most of them.
Yeah.
Most of them. We're talking like New York Dolls kind of stuff, and like, which gave birth to the glam shit with Bowie. But I'm talking more like Alice Cooper, right? And Ozzy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the shock rock stuff, especially Alice Cooper.
Yeah, well, he was the godfather of the whole shock rock scene.
Right.
Yeah,
them
sure.
And Kiss.
Yeah, but Kiss, they were theatrical, but they didn't have the props like Alice did, like in the big giant...
Yeah, cutting his own head off.
The guillotine and the monsters that came out on stage.
Coming out with his Bowie. Look, people are saying shit. What are they saying, Mark?
They're saying, go fuck yourself over there.
Good to see Mark has material in front of him. I think that's your wife. Your wife just commented, too.
Oh, okay.
That's fantastic.
Hi, honey.
Yeah, hi. Anyway, so they're touring with Raven at the time, one of their long-term idols, the Big Four's long-term idols, and they were pretty successful. This was their debut album, their debut tour, tour, right? And so that's good. And then shortly after that, their frontman Neil Turbin and Anthrax, they broke apart. Personal issues. I read a little bit into it. It was the typical creativity issues, the typical drugs, sex, booze, and rock and roll, the typical Dave Mustaine type shit that was happening at the time with them.
Well, it's pretty much a staple in all the bands,
yeah,
I would say.
Right.
Even today.
Right. And so in 1985, Joey Belladonna was chosen as their new vocalist, and that kind of brought about the Anthrax sound. That was kind of when they found their balls.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's kind of when they found their sound and solidified themselves. Because up to this point, they were on Megaforce Records. They didn't have a major record deal like Metallica did, because shortly after Kill 'Em All... they were getting recognized. Metallica was getting recognized by these big record companies, and they got picked up by Elektra, which was fucking gigantic back then.
Right.
You know what I mean? That was like the A&M and Columbia Records and all that kind of shit. They were big.
Yeah.
They were in the big record.
Yeah, they were, yeah.
Right. So they released an EP with him, the first one, Armed and Dangerous. It was their debut album. But interestingly enough, they included two albums with Turbin performing on them.
Maybe those were pre-recorded. Who knows?
I guess. I don't know. It's kind of interesting why they would do that.
When did they release I'm the Man? That was the best song.
I'm the Man. I don't know.
I've never heard that song before.
Oh, yeah.
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 It's like the funniest song they had.
Yeah.
And Sam Kinison's, you know.
Ow. Yeah. Ow. Yeah.
It had to have been around 84, 85.
Yeah.
You know?
Probably. I forget.
It might have been on Armed and Dangerous.
Could be.
Or the next one.
No. That was on their third album.
Okay.
Amongst the Living.
Okay.
In 87. That was the rap metal first dabble in the rap metal hybrid stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it was with the same I Am the Law. It was with that too.
Okay.
I Am the Law.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's
that
right.
Bullshit. So at this point, we're looking at 1983. All the big four, all the thrash metal guys, they're dropping albums. Right?
Yeah.
They're in an album race. All of them have record deals at this point. So they're moving. Right, Peace Sells, But Who's Buying's coming out. Metallica's working on Ride the Lightning. I think Slayer's on their second album, which the name escaped me, but they might even be working on Raining in Blood. So they come out with Spreading the Disease. It was released October of 1985. So that's when they kick off their first European tour. They start that in Germany, and they're supported by Overkill and Agent Steel, which were big thrash guys at
the time.
They were.
Overkill was huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were big in their own right. I was just listening to some Overkill the other day, and I was listening to a thrash metal radio station, man, and Jason Newsted, the third bass player, technically, for Metallica, his band Flotsam and Jetsam.
I thought it was like Toy Robots or some shit.
That might have been after. Maybe. That might have been after he split off from Metallica in, I think, 2001.
Okay.
But
Yeah.
That band is fucking badass, dude.
Okay.
Flotsam and Jetsam. If you guys don't know who Flotsam and Jetsam is, you gotta check them motherfuckers out. They're tight. So anyway, April 86, they're doing the European tour with Overkill and Agent Steel, and the tour included a show near Chernobyl. And we all know what happened there.
I'm surprised these guys are still alive.
No, that got canceled. that got canceled, and they rescheduled one for another European tour later that year with Metallica. Mm-hmm. And this was, and we all know what happened in that time, right?
Cliff Burton. Yeah.
So that show was canceled. Due to
they
Cliff
can't
Burton,
win.
They couldn't fucking win. These guys were fighting for their fucking lives out here, dude.
The Europeans.
Yeah, something about those fucking European fucking tours, dude. They were fighting for their lives, man. So shortly after that, and we're moving a little bit quick here because I want to get through thrash metal. In the last three episodes, we have not.
Please, God. Everybody's falling asleep.
I know. We have not been able to successfully get out of thrash metal.
I haven't talked about Anthrax like this since 1989.
Oh, there's fucking Mike. Hey, Mike. Fucking Mike. Prick. But
what's your problem?
I fucking hate these people.
Go on with Anthrax, will you?
Yeah, fine.
Fucking retard.
So, anyway, their third studio album, which is the one that you were talking about with I'm the Man, I Am the Law. This is when they started getting the real recognition. The whole album, Amongst the Living, was dedicated to Cliff Burton's memory.
Yeah.
They issued the singles, I Am the Law, I Am the Man. I'm the Man. Like we said before, their first rap metal hybrid, and that's when they started really perfecting their sound. They were actually starting to sound like a studio rock band at the time.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And still maintaining their thrash metal roots.
Yeah, because they wanted to be known for something other than just being a thrash metal band. They wanted to have some kind of other exploit to say, yeah, well, we also, you know, sound like that. So.
Well, they all do it. They all end up doing it. You know what I mean? Anybody that wants radio play is going to do it.
Yeah, I'd say.
You have to.
Yeah, of course.
You can't go around saying, yo, fuck this, fuck the law, all that. You ain't going to get no radio play like that. You ain't going to make no bread. You ain't going to feed your family. Westinghouse, shit's expensive. They ain't going to do it, man.
Is that a TV company?
Well, it was an electric company back in the day. Westinghouse was one of the main, proportionate values of electricity. Okay, well, fine. You fucking don't know then. Fine.
I thought it was Tesla.
Well, yeah, Nikola Tesla was in there as well.
Edison.
With Thomas Edison, the AC versus the DC current, but Westinghouse was also in there too.
Con Edison is what we had in Jersey.
Yeah, right. The only thing you had in fucking Jersey.
JCP&L.
Was Richie Sambora. and John fucking Bon Jovi. And
Joey Bagadona, don't forget about him.
And New Kids on the cock. I mean, the block.
Whoa.
Yeah, that.
Whoa.
Yeah, I know. Back it up.
We're not talking about New Kids on the Block. That's drawing the line.
Right. So after their third studio album, Amongst the Living, is released, album dedicated to Cliff Burton, they do another European tour, try another one, with Metallica and Metal Church. And they also did one with Testament.
Yes.
To promote the album. Testament's pretty fucking cool, too.
Yeah.
Testament's another good one. And another one of those thrash metal bands that kind of made me sad a little bit because people kept leaving their fucking band to go get bigger was Exodus.
Mm.
Like, Kirk Hammett left them. You know what I mean?
It was a stepping stone type of band.
Yeah.
Like, oh, once you get to Exodus, your next step's going to be really good.
It was a gateway drug band, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right. Like,
yeah, if you want to get fucking big, you got to start in Exodus. Okay, so anyway, fourth studio album, 1988, Steady Euphoria, had the single Antisocial on it, and that was originally a French heavy metal band song called Trust, and so that was also an MTV staple. That was, I think, their first music video, and it was featured on Headbangers Ball.
Matt Pinfield.
That's right, Matt Pinfield. And so then they started expanding their horizons with funk metal band Living Color.
Eh.
I liked them.
Eh.
Wasn't that Choked Up Personality song?
Cult of Personality.
Cult of Personality. I thought it always sounded like Choked Up Personality to me.
It always sounded like a bunch of dumb shit.
Yeah. So anyway.
Next channel.
Yeah. Click. No, I thought they were pretty good.
Okay, bye.
So they...
Bone? Never mind, go ahead.
I said Bone Tomahawk?
No, that was a great movie. But no, a band kind of similar to Living Color was... It wasn't Bonefish. I want to say Bonefish, but that's the name of a restaurant. It was. I'll think of it. I'll think of it. But they were better than Living Color. That's all I have to say about that.
That's all I got to say about that. Anyway, so they go on a Headbangers Ball tour to promote the fourth album with Exodus and Helloween, your favorite metal band of all time.
Fucking Helloween.
Yeah, we've talked about them a lot in the past 35 minutes.
I just worked with this guy, Dave.
This guy?
A long, long, long time ago. And he was just like, my favorite band's Helloween. I love Helloween. He guys wore Helloween t-shirts. And like I was just like, dude, I don't even want to listen to anything that those guys put out because they sound so cheesy.
Are they not good?
No, they're terrible. I mean, listen to them. You be the judge.
I don't know if I want to now. You're such an illustrious, you know, judger of all music things. I kind of trust your judgment at this point.
Yeah, you're not missing anything.
Right. But anyway, so... fucking funny event. 1989, MTV sponsored a contest in which the winner, Anthrax, would come in their house and fucking trash it.
Yes. Awesome.
I've never seen that. Did you see it?
No, but I remember when they did it.
Really?
Yeah.
And they were shown, like we talked about earlier, in 1992 in Married with Children, which Bundy won a similar contest.
Right.
Fucking Al. And they came in there and trashed
his
shit.
That was a pretty cool episode.
I did see that.
Yeah.
I did see that. So anyway, now they're on TV, out there fucking thrashing people's houses, which is great. So in 1990, they release a more serious album, Persistence of Time, which surpassed all three of their other albums in success. Mm-hmm. That's cool. It's a little bit more darker.
Well, because by then they were a household name. They weren't, you know, just the opening guys for Metallica. Mm-hmm.
Yep, a little bit more dark, a little bit more progressive, because this is kind of in the. In the age where prog rock, progressive rock is starting to form.
Yeah.
You know, Tool.
Yeah.
Nine Inch Nails.
Right.
Stuff like this.
And it has to be a little bit more sophisticated and a little bit more current with the times.
Right, because, I don't know, man, music to me grows like a plant, except for now, and it's probably in the last 5 years or so, they just kind of fucking stunted its growth and stopped, right?
It's just sleeping.
Yeah, rock isn't dead. It's just sleeping. I don't know, man. I feel like it's kind of pushing its way. Anyway, so they're trying to keep up with the progressive metal stuff, and at this time as well, grunge is starting to hit the scene a little bit harder, which is cool.
But so grungy.
I hate that word so much. I really do. But a year later, after that album came out, that's when they started doing the stuff with Public Enemy.
Yeah.
Which is pretty badass.
Well, it was just that one, you know, album.
I remember hearing
off
that
the
on
the movie Judgment Night.
Yeah, I remember the first time I ever heard that song. I think it was either on Tony Hawk's Pro Skater or Dave Mirra Pro BMX.
I think they did it on Judgment Night, and then they also did it on Public Enemy. Did it on their album, and then Anthrax put it on their album. So they had like three albums with the same couple songs.
Yeah,
you know. But yeah, you know. Okay,
whatever.
Attack of the Killer Bees was pretty good.
Yeah, that was good. I mean, that was similar to what Metallica, what they would do with Garage Inc. I think that came out in 1998. That's similar to what they would do there. This guy. That's similar to what they would do there. They released, it was a whole album full of basically B-side albums that they hadn't chosen and covers.
Right.
And this was also shortly after this album was released, I think maybe like 6-7 months later, could be a year. It was very shortly after Joey Belladonna was fired over creative and stylistic differences. And here began the toss around between John Bush and, you know, which is going to replace eventually Joey Belladonna. It becomes that toss around between those two guys.
Right. And nobody gave a fuck.
Mm-mm. I don't even think they knew. I don't think anybody knew.
No one cared about Anthrax, dude. I'm telling you. Mm-mm. It was just one of those bands that happened to be there, Lollapalooza, or happened to be at a festival, or happened to be opening up for one of the big four, you know, or big three.
Yeah.
It was, Anthrax, they weren't a joke, but they weren't like...
Well, they put out some comedic rock, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So, like, no one took them serious.
Right.
You know.
I thought they were pretty good. Some of their stuff's pretty good.
Yeah. But,
you know, I like them. But anyway, so after firing Belladonna, remaining members of Anthrax, they start, you know, fucking interviewing different different vocalists and shit. They interviewed Mark Osajua of Death Angel and Spike Xavier of Mind Over Four. And so they ended up adopting and taking in Armored Saint vocalist John Bush, which was their favorite. It was a good sound. I personally think that Belladonna, Joey Belladonna, I feel like his voice is a little bit more thrash.
Yeah.
Personally. But, you know, what do? When you don't have a singer, what do? You get a singer, right?
That's all you can do.
Right. So another prominent thing that happened shortly after that, 1993, they shift for... So originally they started with Megaforce Records, right?
Okay.
And then they went to Island Records, which is another semi-small, a little bit bigger than Megaforce Records, but not big. And finally, they got their record deal what, 9, 10 years after Metallica did with Elektra.
Yeah.
And they finally signed up with...
A real record label.
Yeah, with a real record label. I think they were like, okay, well... You guys have put in your dues, and I think we'll take you now. Yeah. You can play with the big boys again, or not again, but now.
Mm-hmm. So that means that Dan Spitz took the money and ran, or he had to have gotten a cut before he left the band.
Yeah, he got a pretty good amount. I mean,
left the band to become a watchmaker.
What, you wouldn't do that?
I guess. He had to have some kind of growing up background history, something in the watch making industry. There's no way you just leave a heavy metal band and go, oh, I'm going to become a watchmaker, guys. Bye.
Maybe it was just too much for him.
Yeah, I guess.
You know?
I guess.
Musicians get weird when they get sober.
Well, the fourth, fifth time around the world. Well, yeah, the fourth, fifth time you go around the world, you're like, really? I have to go back to Sweden and Switzerland and Italy and all the states again.
Yeah.
On the buses.
Yeah.
Smelly feet and people farting in your face constantly on the bus.
Yeah, but that's the fun part.
Maybe it's not fun to old Danny boy.
Or maybe, you know, maybe he didn't want to have his bus roll over and get killed, you know?
Well,
who knows?
Yeah.
So Anthrax was with Elektra for about 5 years. They came out with the 7th studio album, Stomp 442, which Charlie Benante played most of the lead guitar parts on that guy. And then shortly after that, Elektra Records kind of stopped promoting their albums
because nobody was buying them.
That sucks, man.
I mean, it just died. They just died in the
mid-90s. Do you think like that they just got adopted because of the name thrash metal was tied to the back of them?
Correct.
You think so?
And the fact that they were buddy buddies with all the big boys, you know.
You think?
Yeah, they grew on that. That I mean, I don't want to say they're not good musicians, because they are good musicians. They just never had a big hit, you know. They never had that top single that everybody bought, you know. They never had that one hit wonder, if you may, you know.
Yeah, they had a couple good ones. I agree.
Not nationally.
Yeah, they weren't Slayer, and they weren't Megadeth, and they weren't Metallica.
Correct.
And they weren't, you know, Death Angel or anything like that.
Correct.
So, so anyway, after that, after leaving Elektra, they sign up with an independent label. They're going back. They're regressing. They're taking the scraps that they can get, if you will.
Well, you got to pay the bills.
Right. And they signed with the Ignition Records, and they released their Volume 8, The Threat Is Real.
Yeah.
In 2008. Which is a cool album. I liked it. I listened to it once, all the way through, and I thought it was a pretty well-made album. And I also like that Phil Anselmo made a little guest appearance on it, singing.
Yeah, that's cool. That was a nice gesture.
Nice gesture. Try to revive them again.
That's exactly what it was, probably. Hey, Phil, man, could you please help us out and do a track with us?
You think?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because from touring, you know, I'm sure they toured with Pantera, you know, here and there and everywhere else.
Well, this is about the time. Well, Pantera's already big at this time.
Well, yeah.
By 98.
But you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's probably it. And then shortly after that album's release, the Volume 8 album, the whole label went bankrupt. These motherfuckers can't catch a break, dude. So then they signed with Beyond Records, who now this is the point. This is the turning point when you know that they were fucking up and they were headed down a downward spiral, because they come out with a greatest hits album.
Yeah, or that could just be just like, you know, their greatest hits album, because a lot of bands did that.
How many did they have, though? How many greatest hits did they have?
These are the best songs. Let's call these our greatest hits.
Yeah, these are our greatest hits. All one of them.
All these singles that we put out through the years.
It's just going to be the side A of one particular song, and we're just going to keep it on loop, like a 23-minute loop.
Yeah, then maybe this year we don't have to tour Europe.
Yeah, because that always fucking works out for them. There's some touring sons of bitches
we're
over there.
We're taking this year off. We're putting on the greatest hits album.
Yeah, right. So 2001, we're moving up to 2001. This was an interesting year for them because this is that that whole anthrax snafu that we started having in the U.S. People were mailing fucking anthrax powder bombs to motherfuckers in the mail right. and stuff. So and also Rab Caggiano joined the band at that time on lead guitar. They're fucking throwing around, you know, bandmates like every other one of them did, except for Metallica. They were kind of like one or two and done.
Yeah.
At the time. But anyway, so yeah, 2001 attacks, anthrax attacks. They wanted the U.S. government actually reached out to the band and wanted them to change their name.
That should have been their name of their next album. Anthrax attacks.
Anthrax attacks. No, God. With it, just the whole album looks like a letter.
Yeah.
It just says from Haleo to US.
And the label puts a little bit of baby powder in each CD.
Yeah. I don't know if that had gone over too well. I think that's probably like the whole fart in church syndrome that would happen.
Yeah, right.
I don't think they have enough clout to pull off a maneuver like that. Metallica could probably pull off a maneuver like that and bounce back. Yeah. Well, they kind of did. They kind of bombed with Saint Anger and then they came back from that, I guess.
I didn't mind that album. I told you because that was their garage type shit.
That was them trying to go back to
their roots,
their thrash roots.
All right, let's not get into that.
And they were already too far gone at that point. They were already too adopted by the system. You merely adopted the doc. I am the doc. I was born into it, molded by it. Anyway, so they release a press release October 10th, 2001, joking that they were going to change their band name to Basket Full of Puppies. Okay. Obviously, that didn't happen.
Of course.
Yeah, and so they played in November of 2001, they played a benefit concert for 9/11, and which they took the stage in boiler suits with different words on each one of them that ultimately read, we're not changing our name.
That was a good publicity stunt.
Yeah, good little stunt. Yeah, don't pass that shit over to me. Good little stunt on their behalf. So anyway, 2004, a couple years goes by, they release their, I think it was their ninth album? Yeah, I know. Live in the studio recordings, we'll speed up through this a little bit. Finally, leading up to the end, so...
Who is this, Anthrax still?
Yeah, Anthrax still in this
motherfucker. Fast forward this shit.
Yeah, I know, man. We gotta cover it, because you know there's a bunch of Anthrax fans that want to hear it.
Oh, yeah, all one of them.
Yeah.
Oh, come on.
You. Well, they're gonna... I like Anthrax, man.
Yeah,
I thought they were a good band.
I
thought they were a good band. They also did some touring, because Metallica, Megadeth, Anthrax, and Slayer did their combination tour. It's called the Big Four Tour. They did some work with them. Until finally in 2013, their lead guitarist, Rob, leaves to join Volbeat.
Good move. At least it's a known band.
Yeah. And then in 2016, they had a short tour with Lamb of God and released their 11th studio album, For All Kings, on February 26th, 2006.
Oh, my God. Finally done.
Yes. Yes. Okay, so we've gone through Megadeth, Metallica, the East Coast Thriller, Anthrax, Bass. So now, the last and probably the most, maybe not the most financially successful, but the most prominent in thrash music history.
Yeah.
Slayer.
Yeah, yeah.
Slayer. And Kerry King, what a bad motherfucker that guy is. I have never seen a white man with more tribal tattoos in my fucking life. That guy is serious, dude. Him and Rob Halford look like the same motherfucker. And both equally as metal, except one isn't.
Those tribal tats in the 90s, man. Those were big time.
God damn it. Tribal tattoos, Tamagotchis, and fucking tramp stamps, dude. Yeah, that's what it's all about, man.
That's right.
That's what it's all about. Guys were getting tribal and barbed wire. Chicks were getting tramp stamps and butterflies.
And I came through unscathed.
Mm-hmm. That's just because you're scared of needles.
No, well, I mean, look at you. You're wanting to get finger tattoos, for God's sakes. What's wrong with you?
I'm fucking metal, dude.
No. Mental?
No, I'm more punk rock than metal. Maybe I'll get punk
He's
rock.
He's mental.
I'm not mental. I want to get into it. Anyway, Slayer, thrash metal band, Huntington Park, California, came out at exactly around the same time, almost exactly the same time Metallica did, 1981, formed by guitarists Kerry King and Jeff Hanneman, and then vocalist and bassist Tom Araya.
What's your thoughts on neck tattoos?
I love neck tattoos.
So you just wait, one morning you just wake up and you go, what a nice day. You know what? Today I'm going to get my neck tattooed.
Yeah.
Fuck.
No regrets. Not even one letter.
Maybe a big tribal.
No tribal.
Right up my neckline.
No tribal. I can't.
Maybe onto my cheeks.
I can't get behind the white bread boys getting tribal tattoos, man. I just can't do it.
No one gets tribal anymore.
If you're from a tribe, sure.
But I'm saying, I think like the last tribal tattoo was probably given to somebody like 1997.
I don't know, though. I feel like if you go to like the mall and you go to, I assume they probably have a tap out store. If you go like shop at a tap out store and you buy a $50 shirt, they probably give you a little start to a tribal sleeve. And the more tap out clothing you buy, and affliction clothing you buy, and rhinestone jeans you buy, just the further that each shop just has a dedicated tattoo artist. They just continue the tribal up your arm until it consumes your fucking soul and you go ultimate douche and start wearing white sunglasses and flat brim hats. That's my theory.
Okay,
on
back
that.
To Slayer.
Back to Slayer. So their current lineup, they've got King and Araya, and then they've got the drummer Paul Bostoff and the guitarist Gary Holt. Gary Holt's a badass guitar player, by the way.
Yeah.
Really, really big fan of Gary Holt's. Hanneman and drummers Dave Lombardo and John Dead are former members of the band. Oh, Hanneman, obviously, because he's no longer living. Well, and see, the unique part about Slayer, this is the cool part about Slayer. All those other guys, they had, you know, Vic Rattlehead with Megadeth and, you know, Metallica's albums. They had the electric chair with some electric lightning and bolts and a little bit of flames here and there. But Slayer, dude.
They're all about the dark and the devil.
Yeah. Well, they weren't initially, though. They weren't initially. The media adopted that for them.
Well, they always said that the name Slayer stands for Satan laughs as you eternally rot.
Yeah, I feel like that's probably just a made-up thing that somebody in, like, some bullshit article in Kerrang! Magazine said or something.
Might be.
Yeah, it might be.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah, but a lot of their lyrics and their album art, they were heavily scrutinized, man. I don't know that I've ever heard a fucking Slayer song on the radio. Ever.
No, because nobody plays satanic shit on the radio.
I don't know if they actually sung about that kind of stuff, though.
Unless you're Disturbed, which I can't stand them.
Disturbed. No. Although their Sound of Silence is pretty dope.
Ooh, ah, ah, ah.
Yeah, no thanks. Their Sound of Silence rendition is pretty fucking dope. I will say. But anyway, so.
I'll take Simon and Garfunkel any day.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It depends on what mood you're in. But, their third album, Rain and Blood, obviously, everybody that knows Slayer, they know the Rain and Blood album. That came out in 86. That was their magnus opus. You know what I mean? That was their heaviest album, and that was their most known for album.
Right.
Right. Rain and Blood. But anyway, they had 12 studio albums, 2 live albums, a box set, 6 music videos, 2 extended plays, and a cover album. They did a cover album too. I didn't think they'd do a cover album. What the fuck are they going to cover?
I don't know.
What the fuck is Slayer covering?
Who knows? I heard... Corey Taylor do a cover of No Shelter from the Rolling Stones today. That was pretty good, actually.
Fucking, speaking of Corey Taylor, I heard recently a rendition of Temple of the Dog's Hunger Strike that he did with the lead singer of Hailstorm. And that was the worst thing I've ever heard in my fucking life.
I'm not
life.
A big fan of Lizzie Hale.
No.
I mean, she's a good guitar player, but as far as listening to her music,
Yeah, I hated it. And I thought it was... one of the most disrespectful tributes to Chris Cornell.
Well, the
Cornell
No Shelter
ever.
Cover was actually good.
Was it?
Check that.
Chris Cornell's a good vocalist, but...
Not Chris Cornell.
I mean, not Chris Cornell. Corey Taylor. Corey Taylor's a good vocalist, but I don't know, man. I think he should stick with his roots, speaking of which. But anyway, so 1983, Slayer was invited to open for that band, Bitch. That's the one we were talking about, the female thrash metal
not
band.
Not
7 Year Bitch. Not 7 Year Itch. Not 7 Minute Itch. Just Bitch. So at that show... where they opened up for Bitch. The band was spotted by Brian Slagle, a former music journalist who had founded Metal Blade Records, another one of those little Megaforce Island Records independent label type things.
Yeah.
So they invited him backstage, or they invited Slayer backstage, and they wanted him to record an original song for a compilation album, to which they did, and that's how they got their start.
I feel like Slayer just represents... so much evil.
I love it. I fucking love it.
But not just the Satanism. I'm talking about just other evils.
Well, they do. They sung about a lot of shit that kept them from getting radio play. A lot of it, like, was focused on the Holocaust.
Type stuff and,
Holocaust. Exactly. They focused on the Holocaust a lot.
Just, they're just not a good people.
They were very. I don't know if they're bad people, but they
were.
They
are bad people. If that's all they talk about is hate and terroristic stuff, and
yeah, I don't know if they promoted it. They probably just talked.
Well, they
about
weren't helping things. That's for sure.
They were just talking about what was going on and appeasing to the angrier audience.
Yeah, the hater, yeah. Hate mongers.
Yeah.
That's I can tell you that right now.
Right. So anyway, they started recording. They got picked up by Megaforce Records, and they started recording their first album, Show No Mercy. They didn't have any budget for this album. Zero budget. Completely self-financed album.
Yeah.
They used the savings of Araya, and who was a respiratory therapist at the time, and then they borrowed money from Carrie King's father.
And the Hell's Angels, probably.
Yeah, yeah, and probably the Hell's Angels, because everybody in California was in debt to the fucking Hell's Angels in the early 80s. So anyway, they entered the studio November 1983, and they dropped Show No Mercy in December of 1983 with Metal Blade, and it started generating a lot of underground popularity.
Yeah,
for them. It seems like 1983 was the fucking year, man. Like, that was the one.
I like 1984.
Really? Yeah. What happened in 1984?
Just a lot with MTV. Not just in the metal scene, just in rock and music in general. Mm. I feel like, you know, 1984, that's Van Halen released that album. I mean, it was just a big year.
1984 and 1985, that's kind of when the music video, like you said, the music video thing started exploding.
84, man, just sticks out to me.
Yeah?
Yeah, for some reason. That was when it all took off.
I wouldn't know, man. I wasn't alive. I don't know anything about that. But I'll tell you.
Well, then you're stupid.
You're stupid. Something else that happened in 1984, fucking Kerry King joined Megadeth for a little while.
Oh, yeah? I didn't know that.
Yep. Joined Megadeth for a little while to help out old Dave, who was down on his luck, just got fired from his meal ticket, and he moved back to L.A. and needed a little pick-me-up. But he only stayed with them for 5 shows. So, but it also caused a big rift between Mustaine and Kerry King that would last pretty much throughout the entire band's
ooh,
history.
What a surprise. Mustaine getting
Mustaine.
His panties in a bunch over music?
Anybody, anything.
Exactly.
Powdered donuts, fucking anything that you fuck with Dave Mustaine about.
I told you to bring me jelly.
Yeah, you don't start a riff between thrash metal's biggest prima donna and fucking somebody with that many tribal tattoos.
Why?
Yeah. Yeah. So, similarly, that year, June 1984, Slayer releases a 3-track EP called Haunting the Chapel. It was a little bit more thrash metal than Show No Mercy, kind of continuing the groundwork with in the underground thrash metal circuit, keeping shit alive in that genre. But they set themselves up for the future direction of the band, because, you know, their opening track of the album, Chemical Warfare, that had been a live staple from then on forward.
Right.
You know what I mean? That had been something that they played almost every single show since 1984,
mm-hmm.
Which is cool. So, like I said, they're still pretty much self-financing themselves. They're traveling around in, Tom Araya's Camaro, pulling a U-Haul trailer, fucking trying to sell albums out of the back of this trailer and, you know, self-touring, self-this, self-that, until March of 1985.
Double.
Yeah, trying to worship Satan and bring about the Satanistic demon gods to try to fund a fucking record, for God's sakes.
What a nice bunch of young men.
Yeah, at this time, the Anthrax was actually doing a little bit better than them.
Wow.
So fuck you, Mark.
I'm not saying it.
So when they finally broke out in about 1985, March 1985, when they started a national tour of Venom and Exodus. Exodus, that other bastard band that we were talking about that just gets personnel and people
band was
raped
just,
from them.
It was just created to get for stepping stones.
Yeah, they're, like I said, they were the gateway drugs. but anyway, so their second album comes out in September of 1985, where they kind of got a little bit darker and a little bit faster, and they started, cleaning their shit up.
Refining their sound.
Right, they were cleaning themselves up.
Right.
And so it got them a big fan base. The biggest fan base. Got them a huge fan base. And they were actually voted in the underground circuit as the best live band to see, which was pretty cool.
Yeah.
That was pretty fucking cool. But the next year, in 1986, that's when the fucking shit storm hit the fan. That's when everything started dropping. That's when it was cool. That's when Rain and Blood came out.
Yeah.
Right? And they also, interestingly enough, they signed their first major record deal with Russell Simmons.
Is it Raining Blood?
Rain in Blood.
Then why do they have the Raining Blood?
I don't know, man. A play on words? Something cool?
I guess.
They would do that at every other show, too. They would have, like, just when they would play the Rain in Blood song, they would fucking just rains of blood would come down on them.
Yeah.
That's pretty fucking metal, dude.
Not more metal than Gwar.
Yeah, they probably are a little bit more metal than Gwar.
Well,
maybe Gwar is like an offspring child of Alice Cooper, Slayer, and Anthrax in their funny ways.
Gwar was from another universe. They were the scum dogs of the universe.
Mandungus or whatever his name is. What's his name? Hungus Mandungus.
Odoriferous.
Yeah, Odoriferous Mandungus or whatever the fuck. But anyway, so before they start recording Rain and Blood following the success of Hell Awaits. And at this time, too, like we talked about, they started getting that satanistic label. This is what they're... And they're
hello?
Like,
right. Have you seen their lyrics?
Right. Well, it's funny because they didn't have anything else going for them at the time, and they had recognized, they're like, holy fuck, we're known for being Satanists, so they're capitalizing on this.
But they are Satanists.
They've never come out and openly admitted
that. Oh, my. I'm out of here.
Nah, come on. Come on. So they sign with Russell Simmons and Rick Rubin on Def Jam Records.
Weird.
That's weird.
That's really weird.
That's really... I don't know. It was, obviously a largely hip-hop and rap-based...
Yeah, it was the money, the cash was up front. Yeah. Okay, sure. I don't care.
Fuck it. And, well, they saw a trend.
Yeah.
They saw a trend. They started...
Said, these white boys want to do the satanic music? Pay for it.
Yeah.
They're big.
It. Do it. They're going to get
big.
It's
all about money.
Yeah. Right. Def Jam's distributor happened to be Columbia Records, who... refused to release the album due to the Angel of Death song on the album, which was one of their first Holocaust references. If for any of you that don't know who the Angel of Death was, he was the famous Nazi physician, Josef Mengele, who during the times of the Holocaust would perform deadly and fatal procedures on the Jewish community and things of that nature. So... they weren't going to do it. So Geffen Records ended up distributing them.
Okay.
In 86. So although they didn't, they distributed it, but they didn't promote it.
Yeah, Geffen, that was a pretty big company.
It was rising.
And they were getting into the movie producing and all that too.
Yeah, yeah. Geffen got huge. This is when they were starting to pick up motion, and Geffen got huge with the grunge movement.
Yeah.
The alternative Seattle movement in the late 80s, early 90s. That's when Geffen really started getting big. So they release it. They release Rain and Blood, and then they start going on the Rain and Pain tour with Overkill in the U.S., Malice in Europe, and then they also had Wasp jumping with them, which was pretty cool because I liked Wasp. That's a band that I actually really like. I think they're pretty fucking badass. There's this...
Okay.
You don't know Wasp?
Oh, I know. They're White Angle Saxon Protestant?
Yeah, I love it. Oh, come on.
Well, that's what it stands for.
Yeah, but I still love it. There's this gate guard up there where I work. He's got Wasp tattooed across his knuckles with periods separating it. So I'm like, I got you, fam.
Sounds like a fun guy.
Yeah, I got you. He's a real dingle looking son of a bitch. So anyway, they are riding the Rain and Blood tour at this time. And then I'm not going to go through every single one of their albums because you guys know Slayer. You heard Slayer. Just, you know what they're all about. They went through their scrutiny like every other thrash metal band out there in the world. Their following two albums are actually my personal favorites, and I think Mark and I talked about this, South of Heaven and Seasons of Abyss. 1987, they started to record it, and then they came out with South of Heaven, which was a slower, more methodical. They started picking up some of those progressive rock tendencies during this time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And they kind of reduced the speed a little bit because Rain and Blood was hard, fast. That was some fucking tempo, dude. That was moving the whole album. But so at this time, they did kind of the kiss of death with that all bands have to come through, that crossroads where it's, how do we appease our roots and how do we, appease the community in which we started and how do we move forward? Right?
Okay.
So, South of Heaven was the first time that they had reached the Billboard Top 200, and it hit number 57, which is pretty fucking cool, right?
Yeah. I don't have much to say about Slayer, because I never really got into them. I know there's huge fans out there. I know you guys, probably are scoffing at me, like, how could you not like Slayer? but I've never
appeased. Well, it's not for everybody.
Yeah, it's never appeased to me.
You know? I love them. But they, like I said, they had, you know, they...
Seasons in the Abyss, that's the only song
I Great get, album.
I can, the song. I, it's the only song I get for.
It's a good
besides
album.
Besides Rain and Blood.
South of Heaven and Seasons of the Abyss are definitely my...
South of Heaven's not bad. Yeah. But I'm just not that schooled in
right.
their whole
right.
catalog.
Well, I mean, not everybody is. I don't know that I know anybody that...
Oh, I know.
...knows every discography, the entire discography of Slayer.
I know. I do, actually.
Do you really?
I know one person who would love to sit here and talk about Slayer for as long as you let them.
Well, anyway, so this is when the same thing with Slayer as we're talking about. Well, not so much Anthrax, but Megadeth. Not so much Megadeth either. But Metallica and Slayer kind of followed the same regime. They started picking up tempo in the mid-80s. They continued to pick up tempo, and they would continue to be successful, very, very successful bands. Not saying that Anthrax and Megadeth weren't successful bands, but... they weren't as big as Metallica.
Yeah, showing the crowds that showed up and the merchandise that was sold and the records that were sold.
Right.
That's where you gotta.
And Slayer with their merchandise, dude. Holy shit.
Well, yeah.
Shit.
Everybody wanted one of those daggone t-shirts back in those days.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So following the... that kind of finishes it up with the thrash metal scene. And following with that, you have every other rendition of metal you can think of. We had the Norwegian black metal, which we talked about a little bit, which is probably... No, it is the most fucking brutal of every single type of metal on the planet.
I like that better than Slayer.
Do you really?
Oh, yeah.
No, you can't sit there and listen to Norwegian black metal. Come on.
Oh, I was listening to the other day in the parking lot of the movie theater.
Really?
Yeah.
Sharpening your butcher knife about to go fucking stab
people? I was listening to the Emperor, and people were looking at me like, is anybody going to check and make sure he's not going to come and kill people in the theater? Yeah.
Is anybody going to check on him? Anybody going to check on him?
He has windows down and stuff. He looks like he's angry.
Yeah. So
you know.
Yeah, whatever. Post the thrash metal thing, you've got the black metal, the Venoms, and Celtic Frost and stuff. Then you got the Norwegian black metal, followed by the, which kind of set the tone for the progressive rock and alternative hard rock scene, which I think personally is the industrial metal scene. You're talking about Ministry, you know, White Zombie, Nine Inch Nails, Static X, Rammstein, bands like this.
KMFDM, Knights of Reb.
Right.
Front 242.
Yep. And so throughout history, you're going to have... everything was based on, you know, the heavy metal roots. We're talking about Sabbath, Blue Cheer, and Deep Purple, and Zeppelin, right? Mm-hmm. Graduating to a little bit harder, faster, the glam metal stuff, the thrash metal stuff. Then you've got industrial metal leading into the hard alternative, you know, and then the metalcore stuff. And then finally you have bands that, you know, were more my speed in my era, which is called new metal. You've got like the, you know, Deftones and... Korn and Disturbed and System of a Down and all that kind of shit. Coal Chamber. They all started coming out around the time that I started really listening to metal, you know, Typo Negative and, you know, all that kind of crap. Lacuna Coil, whatever.
Right.
So the last thing I want to talk about real quick, finishing up the metal stuff, is I want to talk about the first glimpse at social music networking. Tape trading.
That's a wild thing that they used to do, right?
That's fucking crazy. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of tape trading. Some of you guys probably have, the metalheads from the 80s. But what they used to do is they would, you know, they would produce these heavy metal magazine and thrash metal weekly and all these, you know, Kerrang magazine and all these things. And something similar to Craigslist, they would have a classified section at the back of these magazines, essentially soliciting for new music, soliciting for, you know, guitar player wanted, drummer wanted.
Vocalist needed.
That's how Motley Crue got their start, how Mick Mars ended up joining Motley Crue.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was through the tape trading and through the,
Have you seen the new movie?
The Dirt?
Yeah.
It was pretty good.
Yeah, I liked it. Very entertaining.
Yeah, very entertaining to say the least. So what they would do is, you know, a band would say, hey, I found this new genre of music. It's called, you know, fucking Lego Stegosaurus metal. And they'd go, oh, man, somebody over there in Berlin would be like, dude, that's fucking dope. And they'd, you know, send them a tape, write them a letter, say, hey, man, send me a tape of that. And then they would exchange tapes. And that's how Norwegian black metal and the Swedish metal came over from Europe. That's how it got over here. Because obviously that shit was way too brutal to be televised. I mean, not televised, but, you know, commercially produced at that particular time. So that's how the underground market for those bands was created.
Yep.
And I think that's the fucking...
But it wasn't just... them, you know, there was tapes from Pearl Jam.
Right.
You know, Eddie Vedder. What did you say? They sent it to the guitar player.
Stone Gossard, reached out to Jack Irons, the drummer for Red Hot Chili Peppers, who knew Eddie Vedder, who gave Eddie Vedder gave a tape back to Jack Irons, who gave it back to Stone Gossard, and then the rest is history. That's how Eddie Vedder came up.
But still, the tapes. It was a demo tape. Demo tapes.
That's cool as shit.
That's what they were. They were demo tapes.
That's really cool. Underground market, kind of your first look at streaming music, you know, person to person. And
but it still holds true today. You know, you're going to want to see some kind of YouTube or MP3 for somebody.
Right. Right. So anyway, that that finishes up metal. That finishes up thrash metal. We kind of touched on every other kind of metal. We can't touch on every single aspect of metal because we'd be here until, I don't know, mid-February sometime. So
did we touch on aluminum?
No. Later.
Later.
Zinc?
Wasn't on there?
I think next week, guys, we are going to go through a little bit of how the electric guitar started. We're going to talk about Leo Fender. We're going to talk about Les Paul. And we're going to get real jiggy with how rock and roll began.
It's going to be a fun episode.
Right. We love you. Stay tuned for next week.
Bye.
Bye.